Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. This week, we have three examples of achievement with the aid of grit, determination, and smarts. First, a meditation on the condition of our condition. Here's Carolyn DuPont, host of our series, You're Polarized, I'm Polarized, The Way to a Shared American Future, in a conversation recorded in the week following Thanksgiving with Rich Harwood, founder of the Harwood Institute for Public Innovation.
Welcome to the program, Rich.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to ask you just to start by saying briefly what the Harwood Institute is all about. What are you trying to achieve and how are you trying to achieve it?
Well, I think, you know, at a time when our country is divided, when we can't seem to make progress, where so many communities are stuck, where, frankly, so many people have lost hope. Once the Institute is interested in and has been for 35 plus years now, is how do we bring people together across divides? How do we create a culture of shared responsibility in communities? And how do we create, how do we make community a common enterprise where community is not just for some of us, but for all of us? And how do we equip people in communities to actually do this work? And so an approach that we've developed over the last 35 years now, which I'm happy to talk more about, but has spread to all 50 states and 40 countries. And really, you know, when people ask me, well, so what business are you in? I often say we're a nonprofit, but I say, you know, I believe that we're in the business of what does it mean to really create authentic hope, that people can believe that tomorrow actually can be better than today, that they have a sense of personal and shared agency, that each of us feel as though our dignity is upheld, that we believe that we can actually come together and make a difference, that we can restore our belief in ourselves, that we can get things done in this country, and that we can put our communities and this country on a more hopeful, more equitable, more inclusive, more fair and just trajectory.
Wow, there's a lot there. You use the word community a lot, and I read that in your work. And I wanted to ask you to say a little bit more about community, because I think that today we have a lot of false community. We have online communities, and those are often negative community. And, you know, isn't part of our problem that we often find community around hatred for people who disagree with us?
Yeah, well, look, I think one of the challenges that we face today is that people can't find places where they feel accepted, where they feel seen and heard, where they feel validated, where their voice matters, where they believe that they matter. And so we have a kind of underlying condition. I think it's actually worse than the notion of polarization. I think we're facing a fight or flight response to the pressures and anxieties and fears in society. And as you know, Carolyn, when people are in a fight or flight mode, what they're looking for is acceptance and validation. It's a place, a sense of belonging. So if we can't find it in the larger community, then we seek it out. And increasingly, as you've alluded to, what we're doing is we're finding it in small niches. We're finding it in special interest groups. We're finding it in groups that are conveying hatred and bigotry. We're finding it online, where we end up in these algorithms and lost in rabbit holes, but where we ultimately find a sense of home, a sense of place, a sense of belonging. So, look, I think if we want to combat this fight or flight response in our society, which is a very natural human response,
sure,
then I think what we're going to have to do is find better ways to help people feel seen and heard, feel valued, feel like there's a sense of place for them in society. And I think that's missing today.
You mentioned the problem of polarization. I mean, you said that it's worse than that. But you've also said that polarization is a misdiagnosis.
Right.
Would you say more about that?
Yeah, as I've traveled the country the last 35 years, and in particular over the last handful of years, what I find is that, you know, we are polarized in the sense that our politics are polarized, and a lot of people are making a lot of money off that.
Yeah.
our political candidates are seeking votes around that. The news media are seeking viewers and listeners and readers around that. Social media are seeking eyeballs around that and engagement. Much of it is manufactured. And so when we've done work in places like Reading, Pennsylvania, around education, at the height of the culture war on education, It would have been easy for that issue to be polarized because it already had been polarized by our politics. And yet, when we ask people about what they value for their communities, what we ask people what they valued for their children and youth, what we ask people what matters to them in their daily lives, they weren't polarized. In fact, across the political spectrum, I couldn't tell who was a Republican and who was a Democrat. And during the height of these culture wars, people came together in Reading and forged a common sense, community-led, community-driven education agenda that they are now taking action on, creating transformational systemic change on. So I think so long as we insist that issues will be framed in politicized terms, we will be polarized. But if we can shift the frame to what matters to people in their lives, we find that there's so much agreement that we can move on. If it's not Reading, I can talk about Jim Jordan's congressional district. Yeah. If it's not that, I can talk about Matt Gaetz's congressional district, all places where our work has been used and where we're finding that there's more agreement than that which divides us. And while there are real differences, we can move forward together.
Does talking about the problem as polarization then make it worse? Or do you think that we need to reframe how we talk about this then?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And I know that's not shared by a lot of folks, but what I would say is that we are creating a self-fulfilling prophecy in America, that because we talk so much about polarization, people have come to believe we're polarized, and then we act and behave in ways that mimic polarization. I think we hide behind the notion of polarization. I think it allows us to fight for our cause. It allows us to hold grievances. It allows us not to have to grieve about loss that we've experienced in our lives and in society. It allows for us to battle it out as opposed to doing the hard work we need to do to come together and figure things out. And importantly, to be vulnerable, to say, you know, here's my concern. What's your concern? Where can we meet on something that we can begin to take action on together? And in doing so, we can begin to strengthen our sense of civic confidence in ourselves and in one another that we can do this together. We can strengthen our sense of belief, and we can actually demonstrate we can get some stuff done.
You know, it's very interesting to me, and what you just said sort of prompts this. I'm a American history professor, and of course, just ended the semester. And of course, we end talking about the Civil War. And I find it so interesting, you know, that was a time of division, but it was clear what the issue was. And I often think about what is happening in the United States today. It's not clear to me what the issue is. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be, you know, a basket of issues. But surely there must be something deeper going on than just that we don't agree about abortion or foreign policy or immigration. What do you think is the deeper thing at play here? So if, you know, 100 years from now, what would we say was the issue that's dividing, or the thing that is creating this negative narrative that we have about ourselves right now?
I actually think the issue today is a crisis of belief. And I know that's different than the civil rights movement. I know that's different than women's suffrage. I know that's different than the labor movement or child welfare laws, which were all different periods in American history. But I actually believe it's a crisis of belief that we have lost faith in our institutions and in our leaders and in our news media, that we have come out of COVID and we became isolated from one another, and we have a crisis of belief in science, and that we have a crisis of belief in our faith, in religion. And so I think this crisis of belief transcends so many things in our lives and in our shared society that's where I've arrived. And, you know, when I say that, I have echoes of people who said, well, you know, we face a malaise in the country. We face different challenges. You know, throughout recent times, people have used these phrases and they've been bombarded and pummeled because it showed a lack of faith in society. And actually, when I think of a crisis of belief, I think of patriotism. And I actually think of the real meaning of patriotism when you study it, which, as you know well, means love of country, devotion. And when I think of crisis of belief, I think that we are called to be patriots, not the false patriotism of jingoism or the false patriotism of simply waving the flag or the false patriotism of trashing the country as if nothing is ever right with it. I think it's the deep patriotism that when you love something so deeply, you stick with it, especially when you don't like what's happening, and especially when you believe it might be off track, and especially when you believe you've lost a sense of belief in it, and that belief needs to be restored. And so I think that also is part of this equation.
Could it also be a lack of belief in one another?
Absolutely.
That we don't any longer have confidence that our fellow Americans want what is best for us. And so that creates this fear and mistrust that you've spoken about.
Absolutely. And I hear people talk about this all the time. And I think it's why there are so many grievances in society today. I mean, you know, in Kentucky, part of your state is coal country. And if you worked in coal country, if you live in coal country, or if you work in West Virginia in the chemical alley, or if you work in Flint, Michigan in the auto industry, I've worked in all these areas, you feel as though you've been left out and left behind. You feel as though there have been false promises made to you. You feel as though the deal was, we're going to support you. And if we're going to transition from your industry, we're going to make sure you have a healthy transition, except we always forget the part that we're going to provide the healthy transition.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And in the meantime, fentanyl and opioids and meth infiltrated your communities, and we didn't do a whole heck of a lot about it. So you're aggrieved, and I believe with good reason. And I think those grievances have permeated our society. You know, I've often said it, you can't go anywhere and speak to anyone who doesn't have a grievance. We are a nation filled with grievances. And when people feel aggrieved and they don't think that people are acting on it, we lose trust. We lose faith in one another. And that's why I believe we so desperately need a new civic path forward, where we come together in our local communities and not simply do things, but do things in a certain way that both produces results and, importantly, restores our civic culture in such a way that we produce greater trust. We forge better relationships. We restore our sense or reclaim our sense of agency. We build our belief in ourselves and in one another, to your point, that we can actually come together amid our differences and still get things done in America, not as Republicans or Democrats or independents, but as Americans.
So what I hear you saying is that some of us need to take our eyes off the show that's happening at the national level and cast our gaze more locally and invest in what is close to us and prioritize the people, the places, the institutions that we can shape and that we can influence that are right here next to us. Is that part of your recommendation?
Yeah, I love how you put it, though. Take our eye off the show that's happening nationally. Absolutely. The show that's happening around us is contaminating our public square and contaminating our public lives and, frankly, contaminating our spirit and our faith in one another and our ability to do things. So, yes, I believe, much like throughout American history, not always, but oftentimes, the change we need is going to begin in our local communities and hopefully take root, grow, and spread from there and spread like a positive contagion in our society, much like it has in Reading, Pennsylvania, or in other communities where I've worked. And I think that's what we're called to do against it. And I think that's one of our great tasks today.
I noticed just in our conversation and your materials that a lot of your work is connected to local schools and to education. And of course, as an educator, I'm keenly interested in this. But I'm also curious, it's something I mull a lot. Why is it that education has become such a lightning rod for our current political crisis, in our current political landscape? Why does so much of it focus on our education system?
Yeah, I think there are two things here, both the bad and the good. To start off with, I think in response to your question, I think when people are aggrieved, when they feel like they're losing control, when they've lost faith, they look for where they can exert some modicum of control. Where's their sphere of influence? And education is the most local thing that we do in our society collectively. And so I think that's one reason. It's nearby. Second, it deals with our kids. So one could say we're trying to be protective. The other is that we're using our kids as pawns in a political battle. The third thing is I actually happen to believe that beneath the culture wars, let's say, about books a third grader should be reading or whether or not teachers should be teaching certain things to our kids. I have two kids. I think there are some legitimate questions as a society we need to ask and that people are asking. They're legitimate questions. The problem is they become politicized questions. Mm-hmm. And we have forfeited the ability to actually deal in a productive and constructive way with the questions that people are actually asking. So I think that's one set of challenges. The other is the reason why the Institute works so much on education and has since the day the Institute was founded is because we found it is the best proxy for how we think about community, how we think about our relationship to one another, how we think about our sense of agency, how we think about our sense of connection and belonging. And so while I would say, yes, it has become the battleground in our society and many of our communities, I also believe it's the seedbed for how we can come together and rebuild trust and move forward. And I think that's a real opportunity for us.
Yeah, you know, it struck me as you were talking that a lot of the polarization. And I'm still working with your concept that maybe we shouldn't frame it that way, but just if I may be allowed to work with it for a minute, it's about framing who is virtuous and who is evil. Mm-hmm. That there's no one more evil than someone who's exploiting children. And there's no one more virtuous than those who are protecting children. So as long as we can talk about ourselves and those that we oppose in those kinds of terms, that presents a pretty stark contrast. And so I just see that as a convenient way of framing this notion that we fall into so deceptively, I think, of putting people in baskets of who's good and who's evil. And, of course, we always put ourselves in the basket of we're the virtuous ones and the people who don't vote like me, they're the evil ones, which is, of course, is a terribly dangerous way to think about it and an untrue way to think about it.
Yeah, I'm just curious. So what do you think the implication of that is?
Oh, I haven't thought through that. I don't know. Have you got an idea about it?
Well, as I was listening, first of all, I think it's a great point. I think when people are gripped by fear, I think when people don't feel a sense of belonging, I think when people don't feel seen and heard, most basically, we're looking for ways to lift ourselves up. We're looking for ways to feel that we have some sense of agency. We're looking to remind ourselves or to claim that we're good. And so I think in that sense, I love the use of the word virtuous in this context. In that sense, because it's so powerful, I think in that sense, we all would like to believe that we're virtuous and that we're fighting on the side of virtue. And that we can win the battle for virtue. And, you know, in some of the work that we're doing, I'm being followed around by groups that, you know, kind of fit this description. And this has been true. So this is true now. It was true when I worked in Youngstown. It was true when I worked in Flint. It's been true in a lot of the communities that I've worked with. My approach to that always is to keep reaching out, to keep finding out what matters to people, to keep trying to validate people as opposed to invalidate people, which is often our response. And at the same time, Caroline, to send signals to people that while I do that, I will always uphold your dignity, but you do not have the right to take away my dignity. Mm-hmm. That dignity is a two-way road. It's not a single lane going in the direction.
But I think when we extend dignity to others, we open the door for them to extend it back. Well, gosh, I've really enjoyed this conversation and wish we could keep going. I want to ask you just one final question, although I actually have many more. But I'm just thinking about some of the words you used over the course of our conversation. And I heard grief and grievance on the one hand, which I think are related words. They both speak to a sense of loss.
Right.
And I know that that word has been used to describe, many people have used that word to describe their feelings since the election. And, of course, other people would have used that word in 2020 to describe their sense after the election. But then, you know, kind of contrasting that is your use of the word hope. And you said people are looking for hope. So what would be your recommendation of something that someone could do tomorrow to help find their way out of grief and into hope in the sort of larger sense? And let me just maybe refine that the question a little bit by saying that I think that there is a grief when you feel that your country or the institutions that you've always believed represented certain things or did certain things in the world or did certain things in American life, that you feel a sense of grief when you maybe think that they're not that anymore. And so what would be your prescription for someone that's trying to move past grief and have more hope?
Wow, what a great question. Well, first, as you know, the challenge with grief is that when we shut it down, when we shunt it aside, when we don't acknowledge it, we become aggrieved.
Yeah.
Right? And that leads us to places of bitterness, of fear, of anxiety, of separation, trying to act virtuous versus those who aren't. And so I think the first thing that I would say is that if you feel a sense of grief, the only way through that is to explore your sense of loss. You can't move through grief without exploring loss. It's not possible. And so there is a process of grieving that needs to take place. And you can't short circuit that. You can't skip over it. You can't pretend it doesn't exist. There's a loss involved. The way to get to hope actually is through grieving and ultimately to free yourself from the burden of that, which doesn't mean you need to forget, but it does mean you can move through. And then to do something. Hope is engendered by creating something. Hope is engendered by reaching out to other people. Hope is engendered not by solving problems, but by taking a stab at problems. Hope is engendered by building with others and discovering that we have a shared humanity, that we each have something to bring to the task, that we can take a step forward and yes, get knocked down, but hope is engendered by the fact that we get back up and we keep moving. Hope is engendered when we share stories with one another about what we've done amid the real challenges that we face. And so what I would say is to do this, A, we have to face our loss and grieve. And second, B, we need to do something. Something big, not something grand, not something complex and shiny, just a small step, one step at a time.
I have a number of friends who didn't vote like I vote, and I was just on the phone with one of them, and, you know, we're going to have lunch together so that we can talk about the decisions that we made around the election. And I'm so grateful, you know, that I have people in my life that I can talk with in that way, because it helps to work through that process of grief. And to me, that's doing something.
Yes.
To find hope. Because when I get in touch with the basic goodness of these people that didn't make the choice I made in the election, I know that they are good people. That gives me hope. It's very affirming. And so maybe it's calling up somebody that the news media tells you you should be angry with and making the time to talk to them. Maybe it's something that simple. So,
yeah, you're getting, as you put it really well before, you're getting past the national show.
Yeah. Because I don't have to live with the national show, but I do have to live with my neighbor. So
that's right.
Yeah. Well, I've enjoyed this conversation so much, and thank you for making time for us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Contributing host Carolyn DePont with Rich Harwood, founder of the Harwood Institute for Public Innovation.
Yeah, oh yeah, what condition my condition was in.
In a moment, what UK football great Nate Northington has in common with Carly and Asa O'Neill of West Liberty, Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
When you support WEKU, you are making it possible to produce programs like Eastern Standard, focusing on Central and Eastern Kentucky, what the regions share in common, and what makes each distinctive. Featuring interviews by host and editor Tom Martin and a growing roster of contributors, Eastern Standard is professionally produced by sound designer and technical director Neil Kesterson. This weekly current affairs program is made possible by your support of WEKU. You can join our community of supporters by calling 800-621-8890 or contributing online at weku.org. The WEKU Daily News Podcast is now available for download. It's available weekday afternoons and includes the top five stories of the day. The WEKU News Podcast is available on the WEKU app, Apple, Spotify, and WEKU.org.
It's always good and often inspiring to hear from people who have achieved great and interesting things. We have three to share with you, beginning with the guest of contributing interviewer, Gerald Smith.
Nathaniel Northington was born in Louisville, Kentucky, to William and Flossie Northington. He was an outstanding high school football player. In his junior year at Thomas Jefferson High School in Louisville, he led the team in touchdowns. In his senior year, he excelled in academics as well as becoming a member of the Beta Club and the National Honor Society. On December the 19th of 1965, Nate Northington became the first African-American athlete to sign a scholarship to play at the University of Kentucky, as well as in the Southeastern Conference. In 1966, when that season began, he and Greg Page were the only two African-Americans on the freshman roster. In 1967, Page suffered a tragic neck injury and died. And then on the next day, September the 30th of 1967, Northington broke the SEC color barrier when he entered the game in a contest against Mississippi. He would soon leave UK to graduate from Western Kentucky University with a BA degree in business administration, and years later would become a regional director for property management with the Louisville Metro Housing Authority. Currently, Elder Nate Northington is the pastor of the Newburgh Apostolic Church in Louisville. The second edition of his book, titled Still Running, My Life as the First Black Football Player in the SEC, was recently published by the University Press of Kentucky and is now available for purchase. Good afternoon, Nate, and welcome to Eastern Standard.
Good afternoon, Gerald. How are you today?
I'm doing okay. 25 years ago, Nate, I invited you to participate on a panel that I had organized on UK and the Black Athlete. And at that particular time, you were not ready to discuss your experiences. So my first question is, what led you to eventually write this book?
I think it was a combination of things that took place. oftentimes I would get requests for interviews, and one that stands out is one that I received from Sports Illustrated. You know, after the interview with them and the article came out, I wasn't really happy with the final results. And what I found out was that a lot of times what you say in the course of an interview doesn't always come out the way that you think that it should. So I felt that, you know, rather than continue to have someone else determine or slant it the way that they would like to, I decided it was best to do it myself. And it was it is history, something that I felt like that the coming generation, the current generation, really needs to know about the history of integration. You know, I know today there's a lot of things going on as far as banning books and things of that nature. But at that time, you know, I felt like it was important that I put down in writing my own experiences as the first African-American football player in the SEC.
So let's begin going back to the mid-1960s. And as I mentioned earlier, that you and Greg Page were the only two African-Americans on that 1966 freshman roster. And what do you remember about Greg Page? What was your relationship like?
We had an excellent relationship. We were, of course, roommates. As freshmen, actually, we lived in a dormitory that included all the football team. And Greg and I were roommates along with two other football players, freshman players, in the freshman dorm, varsity dorm. Greg was just the person that had an outstanding, you know, outgoing personality. So we hit it off immediately and became good friends. And we did a lot of things together, being the only two African-Americans on the team, blacks on the team. Greg was a person who had a lot of, had a great personality, get along with almost anybody, made friends very easily, and just an outgoing, outstanding, he was a big guy, but he had a big heart as well. So we had a great relationship.
What do you recall about being a black student on the football team at the University of Kentucky in the 1960s? Are there any things that stand out that you'd like to share about what it was like in 1966, 1967 on the campus at UK, and especially being in the spotlight like the two of you all were?
I guess the biggest thing that I remember is that there wasn't very many black students. Of course, you know, when I was being recruited, I inquired of one of the assistant coaches as to how many African-American blacks that we had on the campus. And I think the number was a little bit inflated that I got, because when I got there, I didn't see but a fraction of what I was told. So it was different. You know, I came from a predominantly pretty much all black neighborhood in Louisville, grew up in a pretty much a segregated environment up until 10th grade. So, but you know, we had a good high school, was very, very integrated, and teammates were very good teammates. We got along well, got along fine. So the campus was different. Walking through campus, not seeing many faces like myself, and classes, you generally might be the only black in the class. It was different, you know. And of course, on the team, didn't have, you know, had some friends like Phil Thompson. He was from Louisville. We played against him in high school. We were roommates, as a matter of fact, as well. There was four in a room. There was another guy named Marty New, who was a roommate from Ohio. He and I, Phil, Marty, myself, Greg, were roommates. And we got along very well. And campus, you know, was different. The team, I think a lot of players, we did have a lot of players, fortunately, that came from the North that had played football with blacks, Ohio, from Pennsylvania, New Jersey. So that made it a lot, you know, pretty good, not bad for the relationships with those.
I won't go into the discussion of the recruitment because all that's in your book and your meeting with then Governor Ned Breathitt. And that whole experience with you and your family, and, you know, hopefully people will pick up a copy of the book and read about all of that. But, you know, this is the second edition of the book, and there are a number of things that had taken place since the book first came out in 2013. So it's been updated significantly. And, you know, one of the things I want to talk to you about is in 2016, you know, when the University of Kentucky dedicated the bronze statues of four black football players, you and Greg Page and Wilbur Hackett and Houston Hogg. What was that experience like for you?
Oh, wow. That was a remarkable, wonderful experience. I was honored tremendously to, I was inducted, Greg and I, to the UK Athletic Hall of Fame previous year. And at that time, AD, Mitch Barnhart, announced that a statue was going to be commissioned and built, so constructed. So when it came the year later, and it was tremendous experience, tremendously honored for my family to be able to come down, my children were able to come out to visit, to see the statue. There was a lot of people there, a lot of fanfare, and it was just remarkable. I felt tremendously honored that university, football program, AD would honor us in such a way. It's been a while. It's been, I think it was about 50 years, but better late than never.
So why do you think your story is so important?
Oh, wow. It's tremendously important. It's history. The young people now, they have no concept or idea the way things were, at that particular time. So it's important that the story is told. It's not always been like it is today. That needs to be known, by those, not just the black athletes, but also all people need to know that, If you don't know where you came from, you don't know where you're going, So they need to know that some people paid the price, speaking of not just myself, but Greg in particular, the injury, the passing away, sort of the injury on the football field. People need to know that a tremendous price was paid by blacks and supported by, universities to integrate sport. It needs to be known today.
When you look back 50 years from now it's been more than 50 years since you did all that. When you return back to Lexington, when you go to UK football games, what sort of reception do you receive? Do they have to introduce you and say, this is Nate Northington. This is the man that broke the barriers. What kind of feeling do you have when you return to UK?
It's really beyond description. Exhilarating. It's a humbling experience. Tremendous honor, of course. I feel like that it's not just something that happened. Being a spiritual person, I feel like that it was destiny. God had a purpose, plan. It's a tremendous honor.
Well, your book deals with faith and family and football, and I know faith is very much a part of your life experience as well as your family. And we're just so delighted that the second edition is now available. That's Nate Northington discussing his new book, Still Running, My Life as the First Black Football Player in the SEC. I'm Gerald Smith for Eastern Standard.
All in the Family takes on new meaning with our next guests, Carly and Asa O'Neill, brother and sister from West Liberty, both now attending the University of Kentucky, each doing some remarkable things. Carly, a chemistry major, has received a Voyager scholarship. Now, that provides up to $50,000 in financial aid, including a summer voyage, work travel experience between recipients' junior and senior years, with a $10,000 stipend and free housing. After graduation, recipients receive a $2,000 annual Airbnb travel credit for 10 years. Barack and Michelle Obama and Brian Chesky, co-founder and CEO of Airbnb, created the Voyager Scholarship. Their aim was to help shape future leaders. In the meantime, Asa O'Neill, Carly's brother, a UK senior mechanical engineering and physics major, has been named to the 2024 Astronaut Scholars Class by the Astronaut Scholarship Foundation. There very clearly is something in the water in West Liberty, and I want to find out about that. Carly and Asa, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
So I have to believe that your mom and dad, Danny and Bobby O'Neill, are mighty proud parents. Is it safe to assume that they were very big on education in your household as you were growing up?
Yes. So our parents were, My mother did attend college, so of course she had the traditional track, and our father stopped after high school. But they always advocated for us to pursue education to the fullest, and they knew that it was going to offer us advantages later in life.
We had a very like unique perspective on education growing up. I think having one parent, you know, pursue as far as a doctorate degree and the other one having only a high school education, but they both were very big advocates for our education and pushed us to go as far as we wanted to. And we both happened to be very academically inclined and very much, you know, wanted to go further with our education. So they were very supportive of all of that.
Well, I want to talk with each of you about your accomplishments here. And Carly, I want to begin with you, if I may. You are among 100 students from 44 states and territories representing 88 colleges and universities across the country who have received this Voyager scholarship. First, tell us how this will move you toward your goal of becoming a high school chemistry teacher.
Yeah, so like you said, Barack and Michelle Obama, as well as Brian Chesky, created this scholarship to help people who have a passion for public service get through undergraduate without the financial stress that people who pursue public service careers usually face. So they recognize that these types of careers usually don't pay as well as maybe some others. And they didn't want young people entering these fields to feel the financial burden that undergraduate usually comes with. So not only will this help me, you know, pay off the rest of my undergraduate and really help me financially, but it also comes with the travel experience, like you said earlier. So I think that that'll give me a lot of cultural experience and traveling experience that I haven't got to do yet. And I think that that'll make me a more well-rounded person, a more well-rounded student, a teacher, and I'm very excited for the trips that it brings and the networking that it brings, as well as the financial compensation.
I mentioned that you're majoring in chemistry, so you're working to become a chemist, but you want to teach chemistry in high school. What motivates that?
Yes, that's correct. So me and Asa went to Morgan County High School. It's a great high school. We both had a phenomenal experience there. The teachers there are fantastic. The staff is fantastic. And they were very big about letting us kind of do whatever we wanted to with our education. We both had the opportunity to take several courses that aren't even offered at our high school. One of those being we both had the chance to take AP chemistry remotely with Lou Okampora. And so Morgan County High School, not having a chemistry teacher, they allowed us to have that remote experience with Lou, who is now one of my coworkers at Advanced Kentucky. And so that experience with him, you know, taking the time out of his day to teach both of us individually AP chemistry and really show a passion for helping expand education was one of the first times that I really realized, like, this is a pretty cool thing to help really motivated students, people who have a passion for learning, help them get that learning that they desire. And I just thought what he did was really cool, and I wanted to do the same thing. And I ended up deciding to teach chemistry, actually, because chemistry is one of the most sought after teaching demographics that we're looking for in Kentucky right now. So I wanted to be able to contribute to that.
And so you're going to go on for your graduate degree, right?
Yeah, so I'm going to get a master's in teaching in STEM education so that I can be qualified to teach high school chemistry. But after teaching in the classroom for several years, I want to go on and get some sort of graduate degree in educational policy and eventually work on the policy side of things. I think it's really important to have that firsthand experience in the classroom first, though, so that you kind of know what's going on in the classroom. You know, I don't really think you should be making the rules or laws about things like that until you know what actually goes on in there. So I plan on doing both of those in the future.
So ultimately, what are your plans for making use of this Voyager scholarship?
So I'm in the process right now working with the team at the Obama Foundation to plan my summer voyage. Like we talked about earlier, there's been talks of me going to England, other places in Europe, as well as maybe a developing country or two. But we're still kind of in the works of planning where I'm going to go. But I know anywhere that I'm going to go is going to give me a new perspective on education. Education in different countries is very different. I also have a community and leadership development degree, so I'm very interested in seeing how education works in different communities and how communities impact students' educations. So I think that it'll be allow me to see a lot of that in different countries and communities as well.
Well, wow. At your age, what an incredible opportunity you have. It's amazing. Asa, let's turn to you now. You're, as I understand it, one of 71 astronaut scholars, and you were recently honored at the Astronaut Scholarship Foundation Innovators Symposium and Gala in Houston. First, what was that like for you?
That was a fantastic experience. I really can't put it into words, but it consisted of 4 days in Houston where we were recognized for achievements in STEM research. As part of that, we were allowed to network with astronauts, industry professionals, and a whole lot of really interesting people, as well as we were allowed to present our research, and it culminated in the gala where we received our award. So as someone in the aerospace sciences, this scholarship is open to all STEM disciplines, but in the aerospace realm, it's especially interesting getting to meet and discuss my research and my plans with astronauts, especially since I have an interest in human spaceflight.
Well, let's touch on that. I know that this past summer, you interned in NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena. You were helping develop cryogenic CO2 scrubber technologies for human spaceflight. So I take it your field of research is focused on humans in space.
Yeah, so it's an interest of mine. It's something I've not worked in extensively at this point in my educational journey, just because of the opportunities I've been presented at UK. But it is an interest of mine moving forward. My research up to this point has actually spanned several disciplines, including UAV research or drones, atmospheric science with weather balloons. So I was at the last two eclipses for research campaigns. I recently got back from one in Oklahoma where we flew drones for urban meteorology. I've worked with but more on the space side of things. I'm currently leading a project at UK where we develop small capsules, just like the ones that would bring astronauts back from space, that actually fly to the International Space Station or board other rockets and transit the atmosphere and take data about the heat shields during that reentry period. So the CO2 scrubbing research actually was a little bit odd how I got into that, but it's because I have experience with computationally modeling fluids. And so they had an issue with a technology they were developing and brought me on to work on that. But yes, moving forward, everything space is interesting to me, but human spaceflight is especially interesting.
Well, we'll get back to that in just a second, but speaking of internships, I know that a year before this past summer, you spent the summer at NASA's Langley Research Center in Hampton, Virginia. What did you do there?
At Langley, I actually kind of built on some experience I'd gained at UK working with UAVs, where we developed an ad hoc aerial mesh Wi-Fi network. So the way this would work is it consists of putting certain kinds of Wi-Fi hardware on several uncrewed aircraft and flying them in a fleet or constellation where you can establish a wide range Wi-Fi network. And the reason this is interesting is the use case for this would be, for example, in the aftermath of a natural disaster or a man-made disaster, even such as after a hurricane, as we've all seen recently, where the pre-existing communications infrastructure has been destroyed. And so this can help plan rescue operations or logistics for post-disaster response. And so that was really impactful research, and I was able to collaborate with first responders on that, and it was just an excellent experience.
So, Asa, what's your vision of the future of human space exploration? You just touched on that a minute ago, but I wonder if, given the opportunity, would you go on a Mars mission?
Well, I'll address that in a second. The future for human space exploration is really interesting, and we're kind of at a critical moment, especially with big players like China entering the arena with their human space program. But NASA right now, the Artemis program has been in the news a lot. At NASA, they're getting ready to send a crew of three back to orbit the moon and shortly thereafter, hopefully land on the moon again. Currently, a lunar space station is being developed that will orbit the moon. It's called Gateway. That's planned to be crewed by at least four people, and it's really just a stepping stone. I think that a sustained lunar presence is in the near future, or at least in the coming couple decades. And Mars is on the horizon, although I think it'll be several decades before we see that. And so with that, I'm going to say I probably won't be given the opportunity, at least not while I'm young enough, to go to Mars. So it might be a null question, but I think you just have to ask me at that time.
Okay, we will. And it's going to be fascinating to follow your career, too, and I'd like to do that. Before we go, I'd like to ask each of you, if you could briefly just share what kind of message you would have for other students your age about the value of pursuing a higher education.
Yeah, so I would say for people like me and Carly, the value is pretty self-evident. We're very young still. We're still in college, and the amount of amazing and cool opportunities that we've been presented all through education is just remarkable. I've been allowed to travel several locations in the U.S. for research. I've traveled abroad as part of education abroad. It's opening doors for careers that I would never have even thought possible, all just because of involvement at this stage, up to this stage in our educational journeys. And the doors will just continue to open. So the value is really, it's I can't describe it. The amount of opportunities that you can be given through higher education, all for free. It's the time in your life where people will pay for you to do cool things. It's just remarkable.
How about you, Carly?
Yeah, so I echo everything Asa said. We've both been presented with so many amazing opportunities, both in high school and now at the University of Kentucky. It's been very cool to be able to watch him do things as well as get my own chances and kind of see how our paths have kind of differed, even though we came from a lot of the same situations and the same places. If I had to tell students like us who are in our shoes in high school or maybe before that now, I know it seems like it can be a really like daunting thing, a very like big, almost unattainable thing. But there are so many opportunities for funding that you won't even expect until you look for it. And there are opportunities for everything if you look for it. We have a mentor in our Shelgren program that we both did. And she would always tell us, like, there is an opportunity for everything that you want to do if you will just take the time to look for it, apply to it, you know, make yourself a valuable candidate for that. So I truly just encourage anybody thinking about pursuing higher education to do so and to look for the opportunities that interest you and that really fuel your passion.
Carly and Asa O'Neill of West Liberty, Kentucky, currently students at the University of Kentucky, where Carly is pursuing the education she needs to become a high school chemistry teacher, and Asa is building his knowledge to contribute to human spaceflight. Congratulations on those scholarships and best of luck to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, Studio Dog. We're online at eswku.org, where you can check out our archive, our series, partners, and sign up for our newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions on Apple, Spotify, Buzzsprout, and the NPR app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. And from Yogi Berra, a reminder, if you don't know where you're going, you might wind up someplace else. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.